Welcome to the Meltzone Podcast. This is episode 49, recorded on August 2nd, 2021. I'm Tom.
And I'm Stefan. And on today's podcast episode, we again start with a bit of the rant on 3D printer companies, company malpractices, and talk about Angus's recent videos about paid reviews of 3D printers, why we already have like the 30th or 50th like carbon copy of an Ender 3, what we can do about it, and why there is currently that lack of innovation. The next topic covers something that sounds really interesting in the beginning, 3D printing using orange peel, a artistic Kickstarter lamp that is supposed to be printed out of that material. And we just, talk about if they are really only using orange peels to 3D print, or if there is a bit of a marketing shenanigan going on. And then also, some talk about a paper that I stumbled over where like a real polymer is made out of the limonene that is in the peel of oranges.
And we also talk about other use cases for the 3D printers that we have, as in using them as a three-axis robot, because that is a super versatile approach to using the machines, the first one is a soldering robot that actually solders up PCBs and does through-hole components, and the second one is a plotter, just a brief touch on that. Then we move on to a new feature in Fusion 360, which is every reverse engineer's dream, where it turns an STL into an actual parametric feature-based model. Super useful, but unfortunately only in the paid version. And finally, we do answer a question from Bioluminous Commercial Art Service. I love that name. Why is there no one-size-fits-all 3D printer material?
So your print finished?
The print did finish. It is nice and quiet now, yeah. So that was a print on the... I can never remember their name. It's not Formbot, it's FlashForge. The FlashForge Voxy Lab, or VoxLab, Aquila. A printer that was hyped. Actually, let me show you real quick right behind there. The Aquila hype printer. Like whenever I do something in the three, like everyone's like, oh, you gotta try the Aquila. And I unbox it, it's an Ender 3, as it turns out. And I thought I was going to be able to do a print just in the time, until we start recording this podcast. The slicer, their slicer, VoxelMaker, said 4 hours, 4 minutes. Oh, I already turned it off. But turns out the print was like 5 hours, 45 minutes. So it's even though simple things still aren't solved, like it's still an Ender 3. And if anyone saw the live stream of me unboxing it, I'm like really having a hard time getting excited about another Ender 3.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So the Ender 3 and like all its variants have been already around for a while.
It's been like 5 years.
Are they still using? Are they also just using like a skinned version of Cura or?
No, so the voxel maker they're including is a completely scratch built program, and you can see it's like it's what you would expect from a from scratch slicer. The preview is horrible, the estimates are horrible, some settings are missing. It does slice and the results are okay, but you can see it's just very rough still. And it's like, why didn't they just skin Cura? Like, if I would very much prefer manufacturers to use something that is already there, that has years of development and tens of thousands of man hours put into it for development. Why are they trying to reinvent the wheel when they're not managing to like So on the one hand, they try to do a new slicer, I guess just to avoid the Ultimaker or Prusa branding on Cura or Prusa slicer. But on the other hand, they don't use the improvements and the solutions that we've had for like super common stuff on their printer. So that is, that's my grief with Ender 3 and Ender 3 clones, because he can take the original Ender 3 and it's basically the same machine as this thing. This thing that is just slightly off frame for you guys watching,
just like
the video.
Looking a bit different. So what you want to say, they should have used like the time and money they put into the slicer in improving on like the hardware design of the machine?
I think we've talked about this before, but it's not necessarily you need to throw more money at the problem. You just need to do them more intelligently. And that's what I think Prusa is doing really well. They're not using like super duper high-end component. Yeah, the Mark 3S Plus now is getting a bit old and, you know, it's getting long in the teeth. Is that how you say that? But you can see like everything they do is finished, is polished, is like they're doing a good job with the stuff they do, even if they're using limited hardware like basic LMATUs or you know, 8-bit board in there. I think the 8-bit experience on that printer is better than the 32-bit experience on many of the other printers. So even though 8-bit is like not appropriate on a new machine these days, especially because 32-bit is cheaper. But what I'm saying is they should just like either not make a printer like that, like the Aquila or most of the other Ender 3 clones, they have no reason to exist except for market oversaturation and for trying to take up time and space, for wasting people's time and space, basically. And that is that's basically what Angus talked about with his 7 3D printer manufacturer's sins. They're just putting so many machines on the market to drown out everyone else, to waste reviewers' time so they can't review any other machines anymore. And to like Amazon storefront, you look at what printers there are, it's Ender 3s. And that's kind of sad. It's kind of sad.
I'm always asking myself why companies still think that it's worth putting like a 50th Ender 3 clone on the market if they don't really distinguish themselves, because there are already good alternatives. And I guess in the end, the only thing that they are competing at is price.
Not even price, man. They're all $180. They all cost the same. Yeah.
But this is the thing. I'm asking myself, why would somebody buy one of those machines instead of like a well and proven Creality Ender 3, even though also not everything works in that machine, works in that machine. If there is barely anything in, where they distinguish themselves.
You're thinking way too reasonably about this. You're thinking.
Probably.
Yeah. The thing is, like, purchasing decisions in particular are not always reasonable decisions. And a lot of the things that play into it is just hype, marketing, paid reviews or influenced reviews. The product being presented as being better than all the other alternatives, even though it is not. I think that there's always a new printer. There's always one that claims to be doing these couple of things better. But most of the time what I'm seeing with the Ender 3 clones, it's the Aquila biggest feature. It has a 4.3-inch color screen. It's doing that really well. The screen is fantastic, but everything else about the printer is like zero progress at all. So that they have something that they can market. But otherwise there's nothing moving forward. And for the companies, I don't think there's really any effort involved in making another Ender 3. Ender 3 open source design. Sure, they don't even need to do any development really on the machine itself. They provide some skinned interface, some skinned slicer, and there you go. That's the easiest way to produce or develop, if you want to call it that, a 3D printer and be present in that market.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a bit biased in that way, that I know that. I know that many of these printers exist and they are basically the same thing in the end. So I'm maybe not that influenced by like what you just said, page reviews or I don't know, good marketing. So I might maybe be not somebody who would buy one of these machines and would maybe just go for an Endo 3. But if you're new to the hobby and if you're looking for a machine, of course you are more into buying the machines that are currently reviewed, or even if they're just battery, those machines that get a lot of attention currently in social media. Instead of other ones that are maybe a bit older but do almost a similar good job in that regard. But
what pains me is just there's no moving forward. Like price is the same. The results you get are the same. It's the same hardware. This printer uses the same mediocre at best hot end design from the Creality printers, where the Bowden tube goes all the way down to the nozzle, which is questionable. It's and a lot of other things that wouldn't even require like developing anything new. It's just paying attention, knowing what the parts do, how they should work together, and making a correct choice. They're just making wrong choices in how they, I don't want to say design, because that would be giving too much credit, but in the way that they manufacture these printers and how they put together. So what's the way out of that? I guess it's up to us as influencers, as much as everyone hates that word, but we're the ones to influence not just the people buying these printers, but also the manufacturers, possibly.
Yeah. But I guess in the end, it comes down to having a new machine that maybe makes something different and gets more and more hyped, that other companies pick up on that trend once again. Because like a couple of years before, like many of those printers you would get all had that acrylic sheet design. Yeah. Then the CR10 came along. Then everyone wanted to copy the CR10. Then the NR3 came along. Everyone started copying that. And I don't know what the next one's going to be. Is it like the new, I don't know, at least in my bubble, the hyped Voron Core XY design? Look at the Ender 7. Or I don't know where it's going to get, or where we are going to be in, I don't know, a couple of months or a couple of years.
Yeah, I guess the Ender 3s are good because they're simple to manufacture. There's not a lot of parts to them. There's not a lot of like precision needed to make one. On a Core XY design, you do have some greater challenges that, you know, stuff needs to line up for it to work properly. The Ender 7, that sort of design, they're more complex, and you know, a big design goal is being cheap, right? Being cheaper, maybe not in customer price, but also in how much it costs to manufacture them. And something like a Voron, it's going to be more expensive to build. So there's initially going to be a hesitancy from the manufacturers to spend the money on building those, but also from the customers. Like, how can you justify that this printer now costs 50% more or twice as much, where you get perfectly fine prints? Like, I can grab the, if I don't fall over, I can grab at least the 3D printer. Those are in reachable range. So this one's with a ton of backlash. So, I mean, the prints on the Aquila, they look fine. They're a bit of out of focus, unfortunately, but they're fine. They all print fine when it comes to like the time that it takes you to leave an Amazon review, or the time that you spend as a reviewer with a machine, because you can't really push like 10 spools of filament through a printer to fully evaluate it. But the thing about these printers, a lot of the design choices that the flawed design choices that they make are going to reflect in this thing not working so well anymore after two 3, 4, 5, or 10 spools of filament. And that's like, that's past the hype. At that point, like, nobody cares about the printer anymore. You will have put out the next one already. So, yeah. I guess all we can do is just keep calling it out when they make poor design choices. Why are those two reds different?
Yeah, well, we definitely should. And this is also something that Angus, I guessed it pretty well. And at least on my side, and probably on your side as well, I have been noticing more and more and more emails asking for how much do you charge for review, even. So in the past, usually the 3D printer manufacturers approached us, and now it's starting more and more that marketing agencies get into the game, and they usually have a
That they can spend.
They have a budget that they can spend, and the company that is working together with the marketing agency, they have an expectation what they're paying for. So the marketing agency needs to make sure that the outcome of those review showcases, or whatever you want to call it, is positive and gives them the conversions, meaning they want to get people buy the machine.
Yeah.
So they,
it's something that we need to point out, like, you know, doing showcases, doing sponsored stuff, it's just something that is kind of necessary for online video people to survive. Like, I do sponsorships on my channels of stuff that I believe is worth spending money on. I do make that distinction. I mean, Linus Media Group, on their channels, they also have product showcases regularly that are declared as being sponsored and showcases, and not as objective as a review can be. What's the word? They're not judging the product. They're just showing it to you the way that the manufacturer asked them to, and that they're getting paid for. And that's fine as long as that is being declared. Or disclosed, not declared. As long as that is being disclosed fully, honestly, and like unambiguously, I guess that's the word, yeah. Where the viewer knows, okay, this what I'm watching right now, this is being paid for and 100% influenced by the manufacturer. So it gets really muddy when that disclosure is not there anymore. When it's like, oh, this review was paid for. And I guess in some circles, it's like it's accepted that the manufacturer would pay for a review, and that's just being taken for granted. But to me, if there is anything more than providing the means to produce that review, if there's anything more being given there, that should be disclosed. And I try my best to disclose even, you know, the machines when typically they're provided by the manufacturer. I try to make that clear just so, you know, I'm not misleading people, right?
But I guess in the end, this might also be one of the reasons why at least we don't do like only reviews on our channels, because the only means of earning money with such a review would be then the affiliate sales, and those affiliate sales, for that your video might already be a bit biased. But in the end, at least I think I haven't made any like review video yet that made me more money than I have put time in doing it. There might be some, of course, if the product is good, that might be positive for the channel. But if you would only do reviews and not like paid reviews, or we will give you money for the time that you spent. But can you please only say positive things in the end? A channel like mine would not be able to survive, and for that reason, there's also different content on the channel, because those videos don't usually get many views, and so you don't make a ton of money with them.
A review from a financial standpoint is really only worth doing it if it's a positive review, And that positivity leads to affiliate sales.
Yeah.
And that is a conflict of interest, just in its very nature. Like you say positive things, you earn money. It's being it's basically being paid for having a positive opinion. Here's again, I've pointed this out before, but Patreon, really good solution to that problem. People supporting creators, no matter if they have a purely positive or providing an income for creators, even if they don't like have a purely positive opinion that would generate them affiliate sales, but also to be critical and to maybe, you know, point out when a product is absolute garbage. So that's something that helps in that regard. Also, for me, I don't think you work as much with sponsors as I do, but I try to have a sponsor on every video now. And that already takes care of that entire thing of, oh, this video needs to perform well and it needs to do affiliate sales. No, the sponsor's going to, we've got a contract, like they're going to pay no matter what, and they're going to allow me to keep doing this stuff, even when I'm like criticizing the product. And also try to, like, you know, another 3D printer manufacturer shouldn't be, a direct competitor shouldn't be advertising their product on another, on their competitor. It's a whole long thing. Like I spend time thinking about it and how to do it properly. That's, I don't want to do that much self-advertising, but if you're interested in booking a sponsorship on the show, no. Also, Naomi Wu also translated my review guidelines into Chinese. I've got a website up where I've sat down and I thought about, okay, what do I need to tell the manufacturer, the company, before they even think about sending me a product? What do they need to know so we can make that happen? And it's got stuff in there like, hey, you're not going to get to review the review video. You have no... Like, sending a product does not mean you get a review, because that, in according to German law, that would already be a Dauerwerbesendung. That would already be paid content if that exchange of a product comes with the condition of, hey, you actually need to produce a review about this. I never guarantee that products that are sent to me actually get a review, and I still choose which ones I then review at all. All sorts of stuff that you just have to think about and kind of make up your mind about it and communicate them in the best possible way.
I was just looking at on your website. Is there like the Chinese version available there, or
it's not linked yet? No, I should probably link that there as well, because a lot of stuff does get lost in translation.
Yeah, might be. Yeah, interesting topic. I found it good that Angus pointed that out, but hopefully that turns things a bit to the better, but probably not in the end.
low hopes for that. Because in the end, companies like Creality or all the other companies, they are so massive now that they really don't care about like one or two influencers saying, oh, well, you guys should change. No, they're still going to be selling printers.
Yeah.
Why would they need to do stuff differently?
Indeed. All right. And I guess enough ranting for today.
Are we done with ranting? Come on.
Still some closing words?
No, I'm trying to think of a segue to this next one. Yeah.
Talking about ranting, greenwashing, or things that I don't know might be a bit interesting. Let's talk about another Kickstarter.
Yeah, because Kickstarters was one of the things that Angus did also talk about in his rant. By the way, linked below. Or not in his rant, in his video.
Yeah.
So yeah, did you put this in here, or did I put this in here?
I think you put it in there, but okay. I just did some research in the morning.
So basically, this is your topic now, but it's a orange, so like the fruit orange, based, or what are they calling them?
They're calling it another plastic reduction technique, 3D printing right. using orange peels. And I guess what they are kickstarting is this is an Italian. This is an Italian company that are currently kickstarting a designer lamp, which has like an orange peel vibe on the outside, and that is printed with orange peel 3D printing filament. And I found it very interesting in the beginning, and for this reason I did some research this morning what orange peel 3D printing material could be in the end.
Yeah. So this Kickstarter still running as we record this, but probably by the time you listen to this, it's gonna be done. So it's got 71 hours to go, and it's been backed with 34,800 euros of a 3,000 euro goal. I guess that the 3,000 euro goal kind of hints at how much of a hurdle they have to jump through, or how little of a hurdle they have to jump through to make this thing happen. So yeah. You've been looking into what this orange peel, I don't want to say based, because based gives the wrong picture, material is.
Exactly. So, yeah, as I said, they are printing those lamps that have this orange peel look on the outside. It's, at least on a couple of the shots, really orange and looks just as somebody has used a big piece of orange peel and made a lamp out of it. Well, anyways, as I said, I have been doing some research this morning and thought, okay, are there ways to make polymers, thermoplastics out of orange peel? And is this what they're using for their material? And so at first I didn't find really anything about that. I found one presentation on, I don't know, a university project from 2005 where, I don't know, that team was proposing making a biopolymer, or I wouldn't even say that's a biopolymer, but they wanted to suggest making polymers out of an ingredient that is found in orange peel, which is limonene. And obviously there is a large quantity of that available because of all of the oranges that we are breeding. And do we breed oranges? No, we are not breeding oranges. Okay. We're growing oranges and making juice and other things out of them. And yeah, the leftovers are the pulp. And the orange peel. And yeah, the orange peel, they contain the limonene. And they said, a process where you can polymerize make a polymer out of the limonene and carbon dioxide. But this looked kind of futuristic. So I read over the Kickstarter once again. I watched the video. And in the end, what it turns out is it looks as if they are using the orange peels. They are drying them. They are grinding it up. And as they even state in their Kickstarter, they are then compounding those ground up orange peels with another biopolymer, which
organic,
I guess, for me
biopolymer
means...
base. Come on, don't discount the organic biopolymer base like that.
Yeah. So I guess in the end what they're doing is they're mixing ground up dried orange peels with PLA.
So yeah,
I was asking myself, sorry.
PLA is exactly what they're saying here. So the organic biopolymer base obtained from bacterial fermentation of vegetal starches. That's PLA.
Yeah.
100%.
The thing that I was asking myself is that false marketing, greenwashing, because on other pictures they're saying single body biomaterial from oranges. I don't know. using orange peels as a filler in PLA might be a good thing, to use less of the PLA and more of leftover waste that would otherwise be just disposed. But I don't know, in the marketing they are doing, it looks more as if they're selling it as their material is fully made out of orange peels and it's, yeah, totally green and everything. Whereas in the end, I think they're only using a compound.
Yeah, they're even saying single body biomaterial from oranges. So that, no asterisks there, it just says from oranges. So that is pretty much false marketing. And the thing is also, like, how much ground up orange peel organic matter can you, like, stuff into PLA before it becomes unprintable? I don't think it's very much. Probably 5% or something.
So from the experience that I have with, like, doing my own filament with my 3DVO filament extruder, is that, 5% are usually no problem at all. And you, depending on the material that you're compounding or mixing with the polymer and also the properties of that material, usually it's not that hard to get to 10, 15, 20, or even 30%. Just look at the 30% carbon fiber or glass fiber filled materials. So, right,
but that is like engineered ingredients. That is not just ground up orange peels. So
yeah,
probably 30%. Yeah, a bit tough to do.
It might be interesting to try out. And one of the things I definitely want to try is using coffee grinds and just to infuse material with that.
Protopasta. Have they? I think they've used actual ground coffee powder to add to their filaments, I think, right?
I guess they also made the bacon filament with Joel.
disgusting.
But I guess not everyone who is listening at the moment has already printed wood-filled 3D printing material. But everyone who has knows that printing wood-filled filament is usually a really nice experience because it smells like just freshly cut wood. It's totally pleasant most of the times.
Depends on which one you get. A lot of it just smells like cut MDF, which is, it still smells like woodworking, but not in a pleasant way. Like, it doesn't have that nice pine smell to it.
It doesn't have that nice pine smell, but it has like those caramelized aromas that are then floating in the room where you're printing.
Right.
And I guess that would be interesting with the coffee. And I would think that if you would, for example, grind up orange peels and put them into filament, maybe you also have like a citrusy smell during printing.
Definitely.
So what I want to say with that, I don't want to say that the idea is stupid of putting orange peels into filament, because I think if it is nice for the looks of your product, you can also save a bit of, even if it's biopolymer, but you can save a bit of the polymer base, reduce waste in a way that you use leftover material. But just the marketing is a little bit vague what they're doing there.
Yeah. And it's not like the orange peels and stuff would be like actual waste, because it is being used in a way that is useful these days. So either for extracting limonene or as a feedstock, just orange peels, you know, whatever farm animals like those, those are being sold as that as well. And that is actually something that is mentioned in the other presentation that you found. It's not exactly waste. I mean, that at the very best, you can use it as fertilizer and you know, you decompose it like that. What else? Yeah, so the pleasant smell while printing, Omi's gonna have that. You're not gonna have that at home unless you put a bulb in there that really heats up the filament and gets it to sizzle a bit. It's It's a nice idea, though. The core, like that, they're saying that it's going to be 100% compostable, which, as always for PLA, is something you should take with a grain of salt, because it's not like you can just toss PLA out in your compost pile and it's going to be gone after a couple of years. Mm. It needs industrial composting with the right right types of bacteria and microorganisms. to decompose it properly. And by encasing orange peel into a PLA base that then needs special composting environments, like you're actually making the orange peel less biodegradable, I think.
But I guess the idea behind that is always, well, just if you would compare something with like polyethylene, where you would injection mold that, or ABS or polystyrene or whatever, even if you would dispose it the normal way, just like in your trash bin, it will not probably be there anymore in 100 years on the waste. How do you say?
Landfill.
On the landfill, yeah. That's the word I was looking for.
Are you sure about that? Plastics do last a really long time. They do break down into like little microplastic granules, but they don't turn back into oil or anything.
No, they don't. But what I want to say with that is that if you put a PLA part into the landfill and PET part into a landfill, the PET part either will stay just as it is for thousands of years or degenerate into microplastic, whereas some of the biopolymers will like break even more down, that they're less a harm for the environment.
Yeah, they've got a chance of being decomposed at all, whereas the petrochemicals, plastics, petrochemicals, they just get smaller and smaller eventually. So yeah, I guess that's a good thing, but like, why not just use PLA then? And use orange peel where it's most effective. Yeah, it's a nice filler. Kind of reminds me of the algae-filled plastics that I tested once. Those were like either so poorly printable that there was really no point in using that amount of fill, or there was so little in it that it's like, well, this is PLA that has a bit of a funny smell. So yeah.
But so I still want to give them credit for using that, because in the end it's like an artistic part. Somebody has thought about the design and also the shape and also the material of what they want to use for that lamp. And having this orange that is the material itself, and also the form and the outer shape and the texture of the part, gives it a really nice whole picture. Yeah. As I find the marketing a bit strange. Might actually motivate me to try that out on my own if I can really just grind up orange peel and put it into PLA.
I would assume what they're showing, like the way that it's like such a consistent and vibrant orange, that there's also orange colorant in there. I don't think just plain orange peel would give you that look, because it's a very opaque look. If you have orange peel, like there's going to be lots of that white fuzz stuff in there too, I guess.
And if you have ever like dehydrated like orange slices for Christmas decoration, you know that the orange will turn brown. And there are some pictures in the I think in the Kickstarter where they show that this turns out really just like brownish in the end. So either the final part doesn't have this vibrant orange color in the end, or they're adding like colorants to the mix to have a more consistent result in the end.
Yeah. So the other paper, or the other presentation, I guess, that he picked out or that he found from 2005, and that is actually something that is pretty interesting, because it's not that approach that we just talked about where it's PLA and you add a filler to it. It's actually producing a novel polymer from the limonene that you get out of orange peels. Limonene, you may have actually worked with limonene for like removing the old stickered PEI beds. Limonene was the solvent that you would use to get that 3M tape off. And I mean, even in household cleaners and stuff, it's usually in there either as a just a fragrance or as an actual cleaning agent. That is a solvent or a, is it a solvent? Yeah, I guess it's a solvent. It's just a liquid chemical that we do have in abundance, more or less. And they are, so the basic process is you take that, the basic process, God, there are like 20 processing steps in this thing. But like I said, inputs are limonene and CO2, and you get a polymer out that has, from what I've read, pretty good properties, like very usable properties. It's not like a, you know, like it's a special use case that, you know, only works in one or two cases, but it's a pretty universal polymer. Yes.
Does that make it a biopolymer, and does that make it biodegradable?
So a biopolymer, yes, I would say, because it's from, well, then isn't anything that's oil-based a bioplastic too? Because technically, well, it's dinosaurs.
So all of the diesel and petrol we're using is also like biofuel.
Technically, I guess.
Squeezed out dinosaurs.
Yeah. A couple processing steps in there in between.
Because I guess this is something really interesting, because just using a material that you get from nature, so a biosource to generate a material, doesn't necessarily mean that is also biodegradable in the end, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. You can process something so far that, you know, the natural organisms are not going to have any chance of breaking that down anymore.
Yeah. So I guess PLA is good in that term, because on the one side it is made from starches. And on the other hand, if you dispose it and compost it, it's also biodegradable again and will not turn to just like smaller and smaller bits of plastic over the years.
Yeah. One of the things that I found that needs a bit more explanation, or that should be looked into critically, is like they're saying, oh, we're going to have... See, we're going to grab CO2 as an input, when we're going to use CO2. And even in 2005, they realized, hey, the price of CO2 is probably going to come down as it actually needs to be sequestered somehow. And it needs to be taken out of the atmosphere to reach climate goals, which, yeah, we're doing a great job with. But that's a different topic. So what I'm seeing is that they're taking CO2. They're saying, oh, we can capture it out of power plants, which are, you know, obviously great producers of CO2. And we can put it into this this now biopolymer as an, what's the English word of educt, of a input to that process. Product. Yeah. So we take that as an input, and we're therefore sequestering CO2 into those polymers. The thing I'm seeing here is, yeah, you're taking that CO2, you are now putting it into a product that is captured in that product, but what happens at end of life? Like, what happens when that thing gets, like, if it's biodegradable, once it starts degrading, does that CO2 get released again? Does it end up in a, what do they call it, trash burning power plant, and basically release that fossil CO2 again? You're not really... Mm. Taking that CO2 and absorbing it permanently, you're just temporarily storing it in people's plastic products. And yeah.
And then you also need to account for all the energy you need to produce that material in the end. And
yeah,
that might be more or less depending on how complex the process is. on the one hand, if you think about trees or woods, they're also just like, yeah, they're capturing sunlight and taking CO2 out of the air and producing wood, and then we burn it again and release it again. So they're just a temporary storage of CO2 if we are not like burying them and making oil or something like that out of them over hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, it is a problem when there is old forests that are being harvested, cut down. Because at some point you are releasing that CO2 again, and new forests, new farmed forests, they're not as great at absorbing CO2 as the old growth that was there. So if you cut into like indigenous forests, basically you're making a net, you're having a net emission by using that wood. But there is a process which I don't think is used at any significant scale. Cody from Cody's lab showed that once, making biocharcoal basically by charring that wood, turning it into charcoal, and then that charcoal is a much more stable containment of the carbon that's been captured by the tree originally. And it can be used as fertilizer, or it can just be stowed in old mines and stuff. So that is that would be something that wood would be good at, you know, when it comes to the end of life of wood products. But yeah, there is a discussion whether, you know, for example, constructing buildings out of wood is actually better or worse overall than using bricks. Or I mean, concrete is horrible, but you know, clay bricks, for example, or sandwich panels of like steel, rock wool, and steel on the other side. So, yeah, it's a complex topic. That's all I'm trying to say, right?
Yeah. All right. So, I guess that's it on biopolymers for today.
Why do we always have to cut off these topics so harsh? Are we just good ramblers?
We ramble too much, or maybe from time to time, and I don't want to scare the listeners. So,
but isn't that what a podcast is all about?
It is. But just rambling about something for an hour, I'm really happy to do that. But I think not everyone who is listening might be happy.
All right, next topic then, the soldering robot that he put in there by who was it? Hydrosys for Raspberry.
Yeah. So I guess in one of the last podcasts we have seen the machine that was printed on a 3D printer that then assembled sandwiches and things like that. And this soldering robot, I have seen a couple of days on my Twitter feed. I think it was on Hackaday. Was also really interesting because that guy was basically repurposing his 3D printer to solder through-hole components on PCBs.
Yeah. So it's a longer 3D machine. Doesn't matter, it's an N3. And basically he's using the X, Y, and Z motion to move a soldering iron and a solder dispenser, basically. I love the fact that he's just reusing the stock extruder with a little bone tube to feed in the solder wire to his solder joints, and it's actually working pretty well. So he's doing through hole, obviously no SMT, but basically the components are already in the board. The board's upside down, so you have the solder joints facing up, and the components are already in the board. There's a little 3D printed bracket that holds those components. I think it's just headers that he's soldering here. And then the machine moves to every single solder spot, heats up the joint a bit, or presses that over, heats up the joint a bit, and then feeds in solder at an angle from the other side. And that makes for, I mean, some of the joints look a bit cold, but it makes for a, that's just tweaking, right? You just extend the solder time a bit. But it makes for a really effective automated platform here.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, well, you probably know, how are through-hole components soldered to a PCB on an industrial scale?
So typically it's wave soldering. That is the most common one. So if you have a PCB, you have all your through-hole components, and they get plugged into the board, and then either if you have no SMTs on the bottom or nothing that can get clogged up, it just rides over a wave of solder. So you have a solder bath and a little pump, and there's a little jet. I mean, not like spraying out, but just lifting above the surface slightly of that molten solder. It touches to the underside of those pins, and those get soldered in an instant, basically. Mm. Typically, if you have SMT components on the bottom, there's a bit of spacing just so you don't melt those off. You do the SMTs before you do the through holes. So that's a super fast process. Or I've also seen, Chinese assembly line workers where there's literally a woman sitting there with a soldering iron going zip, zip, zip. If you have lower volume production, that is apparently viable as well. I don't know how hot the soldering iron was set to, but it must have been pretty crazy.
But so in the end, I think the soldering robot, since reflow soldering of SMD components is something that I think many are doing just at home on a small production scale pretty easily, because the equipment is not expensive.
Yeah, and you can order a clothes iron.
Yeah, something like that. If you're having like a small scale production where you need through-hole components, something like that, if you're making 100, 200, 1,000, might be a feasible machine instead of hand soldering everything.
Yeah, he's using like two positions right now. There's two holders for the PCBs. I guess you would want a couple more so you don't have to tend to the printer every couple minutes and swap out the boards. But yeah, it saves you a bit of time. Sure, you could probably solder this faster than the machine does, but the machine does it by itself, and you don't need to be there. You can do something else while it does it. Obviously, at an industrial scale, this is way too slow, but for that mid-range or mid-volume manufacturing, totally viable. Now, I did put two notes into our show notes, and that's how is the G-code generated for that, and how are those holders generated that hold the components? Because if you have like headers and stuff, they need to be that they're not always the same height. So you need different geometry on the bottom just to support those, so that the pins stick out the right amount. And also like hand programming the individual solder joints, probably a bit too tedious, even for doing, 100 boards or so. So that's something that can be done. I don't know if he's doing that already with us, but I'm pretty sure that at least the G code should be trivial, just to generate that from the manufacturing files for the PCB. So you just go to every single XY position and, run a little macro that solders that joint. But that support print on the bottom, I think that's the interesting one.
I guess if you're just having like a showcase of like what he currently does, I personally would not spend the time of programming something that might do it automatically. Take the design and design that the negative shape of that. But as you pointed out, if you're using Eagle or KiCad or something, you basically have the three-dimensional shapes of those parts. So there would be a way to generate those holders for the PCB automatically.
Yeah, especially with the way that, Eagle is Autodesk now, of course, especially with the way that Eagle is integrated with Fusion 3. Well, integrated, it's more of like an exchange format that's being passed back and forth. Like, it's not super smooth. The way that's all one, or that they're trying to make that all one program, like you get Eagle, the full Eagle version with the Fusion subscription now, they are pushing components having 3D models pretty hard in Eagle. So you would theoretically get the geometry of your parts already, and then it's just, I guess, a script that exports it over to Fusion, and then in Fusion you would generate that geometry, that whole geometry somehow. Should definitely be possible, but probably a bit much to figure out to do automatically for the scale that's happening here. Like if this would be something that tons of people want to build and implement for themselves, then that would probably be worth looking into. But for one dude doing this for himself and maybe doing a total of, I don't know, 5 or 10 individual or 5 or 10 unique PCB designs, probably not worth doing the whole export script thing. Yeah,
but so if maybe somebody's looking for a topic for a bachelor's or master thesis and is interested in design and electronics, maybe think about programming a macro that can do that. I think many might be happy, because I feel that the concept is pretty nice. But since I'm not that deep into electronics, I don't know how many would have need for something like that. I know that SMD soldering and reflow soldering is done by many, but I don't know just how much of a hassle that currently is.
Yeah, it's I guess that there's two trends that are kind of working against each other. Like, on the one hand, we get we have access to really advanced and capable machines with 3D printers and all the stuff that they have spawned as far as motion control and motion systems go. But on the other hand, PCB manufacturing is becoming so ubiquitous, fast, and cheap that in a lot of cases it just does not make the sense to either make the boards yourself or then skip the assembly of the boards and do it yourself. So we'll have to see if this is something that's actually people want to do in the long run, to do themselves. So yeah, cool concept. Definitely. It's just, as always, like, how complex is it to use? But another thing that I put in here is the Plutr V2. So that's the Palantir V2, because PLTR is the stock symbol for Palantir. No, it's the Plotter. Plotter V2 by Andrew Sink. Very similar idea, right? You've seen that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I was hoping that you would take it from here.
Yeah, well, it's basically a pen holder that you can strap on a 3D printer that you can use for, like, painting interesting things, or painting things. It's less complex than the soldering robot, but just shows other ways how you could repurpose one of these machines in the end.
Yeah, plotters are still really cool. There's something that's been around in the early days of computer graphics and stuff, of CAD tools, where you could plot out your drawings. Now, of course, you would say, like, why not just use a printer, inkjet printer or something? But the quality and the quality and the feel you get from a drawn plot, basically from a plotted drawing, drawing, is so different from just an inkjet or a laser print, because you can use whatever pens you want. You get those crisp lines. You can see it's actually a vector that's been drawn and not just a bunch of, like, individual ink dots that have been sprayed on there. It's really fascinating. And yeah, having a plotter tool head like that, super cool to have. There are DIY versions, of course, that you can do. The Plotter V2 is something that you can either buy as plans for $5, or you can just buy the complete tool head for $15. But just another showcase.
And I guess, there are also things like drag knives available on Thingiverse that you can strap on your 3D printer. I have seen, I hope I pronounce his name or the channel name properly, I guess our Portuguese friend in Texas.
Try and pronounce that.
Who has put a MIG torch on a 3D printer. The results were not that great, and I might have done it differently, but yeah, why don't you use a like a cheap motion system and make a DED, direct energy deposition printer out of it?
Yeah. This old Tony's done a video about that.
This old Tony, yeah,
just welding up that circle or that tube.
But it's harder than you think in the end, yeah.
Yeah, surprisingly good results, though. I mean,
this old Tony, yeah, he had really good results. Please go ahead.
Not comparable to doing actual sintering, or where you start with the powder and you do like laser sintering and stuff.
But the thing is, for bigger parts, this application is something that is pretty common. So there is one Berlin company which is called DDU. It's a big Berlin company that are doing wire DED print machines to print parts out of titanium, Inconel, or things like that. I think Norsk Titanium, who are also having one of their titanium parts in a Boeing Dreamliner, they also print like a raw part using such a process out of titanium wire. Then they machine all of the outside, and they save themselves a lot of machining because the shape is already like near to the final.
Yeah, compared shape, to machining it from a solid block.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you save the time for getting a forged part, for example, because like ordering forged parts in a small quantity can take a year, 2 years, and maybe sometimes you don't have the time for that. So this is not a process that is totally unusable in the end, but you need to have specific applications for that. Tanks for storing cryogenic fuels for rockets.
Like tank the container, not tank the war mobile.
No tanks for storing cryogenic fuels. There are some projects going on using wire DED manufacturing for that, because scaling up a motion system is really easy. Scaling up a powder 3D printing, a powder 3D printer is very hard, and we're still limited to like, I'd say like a meter by a meter by something else for such machines. But CNC controlled CNC controlled MIG gun is easy. I don't want to speak about the process itself and the warping you're getting and things like
obviously
that.
That's all stuff that still needs to be figured out, but the core is there. And that's how film and 3D printing started out as well. Like, they solved the stuff that they could solve, and were like, well, the results we're getting aren't great yet, but then over time and over, with gaining experience and just lots of people doing it and figuring out one little bit at a time, we got to where we are now, which is every print is an Ender 3. Ha, great. Exactly where we wanted to be. Let's move on to questions.
Maybe this one just for a second.
Hermetic jet. Oh yeah. Okay, I was gonna.
Yeah.
Okay. No.
So we previously spoke about generating an STL out of, or a parametric STL out of a CAD file or out of a Gerber file. So when we talked about the soldering machine, Fusion 360 has a new tool which you can use to convert STLs into parametric CAD files. Yes, that was possible in the past, but in the past, Fusion just like translated each triangle an STL file into like a CAD
surface, basically,
a surface face, and that just blew up the models.
Yeah.
Fusion 360, I think since 2 weeks or something like that, has the opportunity. I don't know how the feature is called, but I can check that. To do a more sensible way of converting a surface into a CAD file. So basically recognizing flat shapes, recognizing like fillets and chambers and things like that.
So
in
the end, you get something that has features, that has, I guess, parametric features. Yeah, you don't just get the solid object, which is like, oh, chunk that looks like this.
It is still a chunk.
Well, yeah, but it has individual features. Like what we had before was just like, this is object finished. And now it's like actual, first of all, it's clean geometry. Like a hole is going to be a hole.
Yeah.
An extrusion is going to be an extrusion. But also you can edit those, right? So you get an actual feature history for those parts, right?
No, you're not getting a feature history. Okay. That's what I wanted to say, but you have, like, so a flat surface will be just one object, and not like every triangle of a flat surface will be its individual shape. How do you say? Flat CAD surface. So the models turn out way more clean as they were before. And the thing is that this allows you to then, for example, just really select a surface and extrude that surface, or place sketches on surfaces and do extrusions and use them in your sketches and things like that. Like a proper way to convert an STL file back to a CAD file. It sounds better than it is in the end, because in the end it's not that easy. So how it works in Fusion 360, it's actually called parametric. When you're using the convert to mesh option, there's the operation parametric. What it actually does in the background, you need to create face groups before. Face groups meaning that you need to group a couple of faces together that form more or less a CAD feature. So all of the flat surfaces need to be a separate face group. If you have ever used Mesh Mixer, for example, that's an easy way how you can, for example, find edges of a part and things like that.
Right.
Fusion also comes with tools to do that, where, for example, like fillets and things like that are recognized automatically. But sometimes, especially if you have freeform shapes or a surfaces that are tangentially connected, creating those features is sometimes hard. And if you are not properly declaring those mesh groups, also the conversion will not work properly.
Okay.
But especially if you have parts that have sharp edges and not a lot of fillets, the face group generation is working really easily. And then also creating the CAD part out of that face group STL file is often working really flawless, and it just opens you the possibility to way easier do modifications on such parts where you maybe don't have the source CAD file or in a step file available or something like that.
Yeah, obviously that also opens up a huge possibility of doing reverse engineering and kind of making somebody else's STL. I mean, it would work for scans, right? That's the idea.
It would work for
scans. Yeah.
I guess that's the initial idea behind that. If you have parts from Thingiverse and you want to like get the CAD file again, that's something nice that you want to have, but in the end, it's a paid feature in Fusion 360.
Yeah.
Where something like that is really useful is if you 3D scan a part, and if you want to reverse engineer that 3D scanned part easily into a modifiable CAD file.
Yeah.
And not just in terms of like fitting surfaces over it and don't recognizing like any of the features.
Yeah, thankfully as long as it's a functional part, copyright doesn't really apply to it, so we're all good there. So what I'm thinking of, like, how accurate is that detection? Because STL is not a format that has like indefinite accuracy as far as like how precisely those points are positioned. If you take a simple model and you export it to an STL on like the fine export and you import it back into Fusion and you use that feature detect feature, how close does it end up to the original CAD part? Like, for example, hole sizes. Does a 4 millimeter hole end up as a 4 millimeter hole, or does it become a 3.98 millimeter one? How accurately are angles preserved? Like, does it? I think that's probably the most difficult one. Stuff like threads, I guess it would completely fail on. How well does it work for that?
I'm not sure. It's probably using some kind of a tolerance in the background where that is close enough. What they might be doing in the background is they are fitting surfaces over either all of the points of the face group that you have selected or over all of the lines to represent those as close as possible and don't even take a look at the surfaces themselves or the triangles themselves. But of course, there's a tolerance in the background. The thing is, if you, for example, have a hole feature, this would also mean that this might actually reverse the problem that holes that are tessellated are getting smaller. Because if you are fitting a surface over those points, this surface is probably more into the part than facets of the model.
Yeah, if you just generate the points on the radius of whatever hole you have, then those actual facets are going to be inwards. So I guess now you're getting the problem the other direction. Yeah.
Mm. Well, the thing is, in the end, it's still a bit of reverse engineering, and it can't do real magic in the background and increase the accuracy of a badly tessellated STL. It can only do a best guess.
Yeah.
But in many applications, that might already be enough, because in FDM 3D printing, do you care about a hundredth of a millimeter?
Yeah.
Do you care about a tenth of a millimeter? Usually not.
It's just about making it modifiable a bit more easily than working on whatever, chunk of part you have or you had before. Yeah. So, cool feature. Unfortunately, part of the paid Fusion plan. So, chances are low that maybe they have like a free weekend at some point, free trial. Well, they have free trials?
I don't know how it is with Fusion 360 at the moment. If you have a 30-day trial and then you can opt in for the personal use or startup license thing. Right. But that feature is only available in the $500 a year plan, or what is it, $350 or something like that. So only in the paid version at the moment.
How are you getting to use it then?
Kind of a shame. Sorry?
How are you getting to use it then?
How did I use? I'm an Autodesk influencer, just as you are.
Oh, yeah. we get stuff for free. Even if, I would probably be happy with the free version. But they reached out and were like, hey, would you like this? I'm like, sure, I guess can come in use. Yeah. So like, I don't think I'm using any of the paid features. This entire bed changer was done in Fusion, and it's literally all like linear extrusions and hole features. There's nothing advanced about this thing at all.
No. Well, me neither. The reason I was looking for that perk was I have a fourth axis for my SnapMaker 3D printer CNC router laser thing, and I wanted to have an option for also using another CAM software for preparing the G-code for the SnapMaker, in comparison to their own slicer or like a bundle software. And more than 3-axis machining is unfortunately only available in the paid version of Fusion 360. So, and well, since I don't do any like contract design work and use Fusion 360 and show it on my channel, I don't know. I guess that's a good deal for both Autodesk and me and you and whoever.
Yeah, I mean, like we said before, with the entire, hey, 3D printer companies are just making more printers to saturate the market. Like, as long as a company is like visible and present, I guess it's good for them.
Yeah.
So yeah, cool feature in Fusion. Yeah, also, one thing that still kind of stinks, my second most popular video, I think, the topology-optimized shelf brackets that turned out with a really cool shape that was, of course, like intentionally tweaked that way. That feature of doing at least the... what is it? Topology optimization, not the generative design. Topology optimization now isn't, or since a while actually, is not a part of the free plan anymore. That kind of sucks. So half of the comments on the video is like, hey, I can't find that feature in the free version anymore. It's just you're at the whim of Autodesk you're at the whim of whatever company you're using a free tool of, if they also have, when they also have a paid version that is featuring exclusive features.
Yeah, it's a pity, but I don't know. We would still have the option to use FreeCAD, but for me, it's just Fusion works. I've been using Fusion for years, so if I do have the option, I would like to continue using it. And since there's still a quite feature-packed personal version of Fusion 360 available, I can also produce content there where there's not a paywall to use the methodologies I show in the video.
And that's pretty much where I'm standing too. Like FreeCAD, I want to use FreeCAD. I want to use free open source tools wherever possible. It's just that in a lot of cases they're not as good as the commercial ones. Like I've tried working on Linux for a while. Wasn't the great... I mean, it works for a while, but then it's like, hey, something breaks and you're screwed. I mean, happens on Windows too, but okay. I would love to use a free open source video editor. I mean, for 3D CAD, Blender, absolutely feasible. Like 3D work or 3D artist work in Blender, probably as good as everything else. Video editors... not as much. I use Resolve. You do too. Which is, yeah, it's a freemium model. You have a free version or you can buy the paid version. CAD, same thing. Like I wish FreeCAD was as good as Fusion. I've not used it in a while. I do try it on and off, but it's never at the point where it's intuitive enough to just allow me to jump in. I know Gina Hoiska actually made the switch. She was using Fusion 360 for a while and is now completely on FreeCAD. So I guess I should just try it out and see how far I get and how many issues I run into.
Might be interesting.
The thing is also what I'm trying to get is is there an audience for that? Because at the end of the day, my job and yours to a large extent too is to produce content that people want to watch. Like, is there an audience for me trying to find my way into FreeCAD? Because in the end, I mean, if that process is not something that people care about, like there's no incentive for me to spend that time on trying to learn FreeCAD and trying to learn how that works when I could just as well use Fusion, and Fusion is just in the background for most of the stuff I do. I don't make videos about Fusion itself most of the time.
I guess maybe there is not a huge audience at the moment who is already using FreeCAD, but I think there is a huge audience for people that are looking for a really free, like free beer, CAD software. And maybe they're currently just not aware what is on the market and how far you can get with those tools. So I am quite sure that content on such a topic might be really interesting and might spark a lot of interest in that direction. And that might also be really positive for such a project, because with more people using it, getting funding, getting donations, and then in the end also getting development done is yeah. just accelerated that way. Just look at Blender.
Yeah, scaling is from what I've heard, scaling is really hard for like those smaller open source projects. Like once you're at the scale of Blender, where it's how many people are working full time on that? 20, 50, 100 people? Because they have like all the infrastructure to work like a software company. If you're just two people, maybe at all working on this, like in your free evenings, making use of extra funding can be kind of tough, especially when it's just a bit and it's not like, oh, we can hire two people and pay them to actually work on the project. Just from what I hear, I'm sure funding for open source projects is always important. And, you know, if it allows people to work on the stuff actually part-time and scale down their regular job, but most of the time people are still working a regular job aside from their open source projects they're working on for free.
Yeah, definitely. I guess at some point you have to decide if you want to basically make kind of a company out of it and have like full-time developers and somebody who organizes everything. And I don't know, everything that is involved in like larger scale software development. So I will not say the name, but I interestingly know one of the main developers of another like popular open source software, which gets kind of in that direction. Well, he told me, yeah, they also get a bunch of donations and support, but they are still, it's still all of them doing that basically in their free time. And the donations end up piling up. And in the past, they use it for just a big meeting every year to, I don't know, fly to a convention somewhere and have fun there. Of course, that's working if people are doing that for fun and in their spare time, but that also gets you to only gets you to some point. But
yeah,
I don't know. I don't really know the backgrounds of FreeCAD, but attention to a project and maybe also support for a project is usually beneficial.
Usually, yeah. Okay, let's leave it at that. And close this one out with a question. Did you like black out the name intentionally?
No, but I think you.
Okay.
Did you use the dark theme in YouTube? Maybe it was me. So possibly. I wasn't able to remove the background there. So everything was black before, and I tried to change it to normal colors.
Bioluminous Commercial Art Service. I think they also had a question on Patreon or somewhere, or in chat or somewhere on the channel somewhere, or it was on the podcast last time. Longish question, but basically you summed it up really well when we went through these topics. It's like, why is there no one ultimate filament? Like, why is there not one that has heat resistance, doesn't warp, prints easily, and can be recycled cleanly anywhere in the world instead of having to pick and choose out of the commercially available filaments? So, yeah, in reasons for MSLA, yeah, that's a different topic. But basically, why is there no one size fits all filament for FDM?
I guess because there's probably basically also no like one polymer fits all application, one metal fits all application. it would be nice if something like that existed, but some properties might be maybe contradicting just in the beginning. And as I said, I wouldn't be aware that something like that existed. Why is a car not made out of like just one metal that is good in everything? Why don't we have the ultimate material at the moment? Because I think it's not existing. It's a question of price. It's a question of properties that might be contradicting. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Just use graphene for everything. Graphene solves all our problems, right? Doesn't it? It's
like carbon nanotubes.
Yeah, exactly. It's the wonder materials that does it all. From what I'm seeing, I mean, actually, like fiber reinforcement might actually be a really good thing if we can figure out how to actually implement them properly. The properties that it's giving, like high heat resistance and does not warp. From my understanding, those are two things that are like exactly diametrically, completely opposing to each other. Like if you have a material that does not warp, well, unless you have a polymer that doesn't shrink when it cools, but like high heat with the polymers we have today, high heat resistance means it solidifies, or it only becomes soft at a very high temperature, which means for our 3D printing applications, you extrude it very hot, and then from like, let's say 250 degrees, and then at 200 degrees, it's already mostly solid. That temperature difference between 200 degrees, where it's almost solid, to room temperature at 20 degrees Celsius, that's 180 degrees. So you take your, or 180 Kelvin, whatever you want to do, you take your expansion coefficient, you multiply that by 180, and that's going to be a larger number than a polymer that gets soft at 60 degrees Celsius, like PLA, that just has to cool down 40 degrees to 20 degrees ambient. So you have a much larger temperature difference, which, you know, causes warping. That contraction of your, typically it's a contraction of a material as it cools down, that is exactly what causes you warping. So it's exactly the relationship we're seeing with ABS, high temperature resistance, but also warps a lot, versus PLA, low temperature resistance but does not warp. It's kind of like, yeah, it's you can have one or the other, but not both at the time, both at the same time. Then with recycle cleanly anywhere in the world, I guess it could work if you're actually doing recycling and you're melting it down. But for example, once you go into easily biodegradable, it's also a problem of, okay, when does the material decide, oh, I'm still in use and I shouldn't degrade, versus, oh, I'm now end of life and I should degrade cleanly. Like, you can't really make a material that is easily degradable, but also long lasting in typical use. And if you don't do that, if you have a product that only lasts a couple of weeks, you're not solving any problems, because you're really just increasing the demand for more virgin polymer to be produced. And that's not good for anyone. So, yeah, and also cost, of course, like you mentioned. I'm sure there are materials that are fantastic, like carbon nanotube filled, crystalline, whatever, but yeah, too expensive. Like, nobody wants to pay. I mean, how expensive is PEK even, or PEAK?
Let's say $500 a kilo.
Yeah, that's probably on the cheaper side even. Like, come on, no. Nobody's gonna pay that. That's over 10 times, or that's 20 times as expensive as regular filament. And you don't need that for most cases.
If you are interested in stories about such a material, read or listen to Project Hail Mary, the new book by Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian.
Oh.
There's a material called xenonite, which is basically the one material that is perfect for everything. Can really recommend that book. Nice read, nice listen. Not sponsored.
I was going to say, that sounds like an Audible sponsorship.
I don't know. I could, but I might be able to put my affiliate link down there. But no, sure. Yeah, I think such a material in the end doesn't really exist. And I don't know if there is the possibility that something like that existed due to these contradicting properties. So there is still the market for having to select a material for a specific application depending on price, usability, property, and things like that.
Yeah.
It's just as with metals. Why is not everything made out of high strength steel? Yeah, because maybe that stuff is not that good in corrosion resistant. Why is not everything made out of corrosion resistant steel? Because it's not that strong and has other.
Yeah.
It's exactly that.
Exactly. And
but xenonite can do anything.
Yeah. Also, one thing that an efficient market should be able to do is to provide you with a basically a selection of materials that the better they get as far as properties go, the more expensive they are. Or actually the other way around. The more expensive a material is, the better it should be as well. Doesn't always work perfectly, but theoretically that's the way it should work. Like if you pay more for like construction material, it should also have better properties. Because anything that is more expensive but isn't better shouldn't exist on the market. Theoretically, again, doesn't always work that way.
All right.
So yeah, with the xenonite reference here, I think that is the that's the episode. We've made it through.
Finally. Thank you for your time, Tom. Thank you for listening. As always, if you have questions, just put them down in the YouTube comments or tweet to us at the Melt Zone. If you want to support us, there are links to our Patreon down in the description. And I guess we hope to see you or hear you on the next one.
We're not hearing anyone. We're not seeing anyone.
No, we're not.
They're hearing us.
But
yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Hearing us in the next one. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Bye-bye.